Welcome back, everyone. We're now beginning the second hour of this special edition of Narsil in Action. And for the second hour, we're going to be talking about a number of legal actions in the state of Georgia. And if time permits, we're going to be talking about how folks can get themselves off of the registry in the state of Georgia. And I'm going to do a little bit of housekeeping. If you haven't entered the prize contest, go ahead and text PRIZE to 747-227-4477, and you'll receive a contestant number, which will be drawn at some point tonight, and you'll win a registration to the 2020 Narsil Conference, which is going to be in Raleigh, North Carolina. For this second hour, we're going to have our special guest, who's been with us before, Mr. Mark Juracek, an Atlanta area.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
All right. And Mr. Juracek is based in Atlanta. He's been admitted to practice since 2000. He recently won a state Supreme Court decision in Georgia, State versus Park. It has to do with GPS monitoring being required for people after they've paid their debt to society. Mr. Juracek has been leading the charge on the two cases that Narsil's been sponsoring in Butts and Spalding County. And Mr. Juracek has been doing a lot of good work and just filed a spectacular appellate brief in the 11th Circuit dealing with this case that's on appeal from Butts County. Tonight, we're going to focus primarily on Butts County, although there is the case in Spalding County as well. But Butts County is the one that's up on appeal right now. So welcome, Mark. Thank you for joining us again.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
All right. Good to have you here. So we're going to have so much to cover, trying to do two things. So I'm going to try to do what lawyers don't do well, which is to keep answers brief. So you guys get paid to talk. Last October, yeah. Narsil had a tremendous victory against the sheriff of Butts County regarding some placing Halloween signs. And this was the second year that he had planned to do it. He did it in 2018. And he was less successful in 2019. And the district judge there, Judge Mark Treadwell, issued an injunction. And everybody wants to know, why don't you just go get injunctions for everything you don't like? Just briefly, tell us how hard it is to get an injunction so people can appreciate what you actually accomplished.
Yeah, well, you know, given the fact that injunctions are sort of unique in the law because they provide what's called prospective relief as opposed to retrospective relief. That means the injunction is meant to stop future behavior as opposed to remedy a past injury or past behavior. And, you know, this is not a country that tends to want to restrict people's ability to do things beforehand if there's not already a law saying they can't do it. So, you know, when there's an unclear area of the law, that's certainly a time when an injunction may be sought, like what we did in this particular case. But courts set a pretty high bar for people to be able to obtain an injunction for the very reason that you're trying to stop behavior before it happens, and it's just sort of a disfavored activity in the law around here. So I don't know if that's the most eloquent explanation, but it's essentially this country is not real big on prior restraint. So that's largely the reason that injunctions are kind of difficult to obtain.
And Janice, you're welcome to jump in here because Axel's in on this case as an amicus party. So when you have something you need to jump in, just feel free to do what lawyers do. The likelihood of success on the merits is really, really heavy in that standard and irreparable harm. And you were able to show both of that, that you were likely to succeed when this case finally goes to trial at some point in the future. And you were able to show that there would be irreparable harm without the injunctive relief. So Judge Treadwell issued that injunction, and I was not clear how he diced it on terms of it applied for our plaintiffs. But didn't the county choose to just not do the signs? And could they have done them had they wanted to? Wasn't just our plaintiffs it wasn't the sheriff only restrained from doing the signs on our plaintiff and kind of cautioned on the remainder that he might be on weak legal ground if he went forward?
Well, there was no caution about it. You know, anyone with half a brain would be able to look at the order and realize that if the order applied to our particular clients, the three petitioners who signed on to the case, that should the sheriffs take the order literally and simply not put signs in front of the homes of those three petitioners, but then choose to put them in front of the other 54 registrants that lived in Butts County, they may well could walk themselves into a problem with damages. In terms of violating the rights of the other registrants in the county. What the court said and what you're referring to, Larry, is that we initially requested that the court certify a class of plaintiffs in the case, that being all the registrants in Butts County, because the sheriff represented at the hearing that this was an across-the-board obligation, that he was putting signs in front of every registrant's home that lived in the county. It happens also that that Georgia's a diagnostic prison where most prisoners go initially once they are sentenced to a prison term. The diagnostic prisons in Butts County as well, but obviously they're not putting signs in front of every sex offender's cell at the prison. So, you know, there are 57 registrants in Butts County. They were going to put the signs in front of every home, as they had, and as you point out, as they did in 2018. Now, what the court said, and I can't put up much of a fight on this, was that one of the elements of the particular First Amendment issue that the court granted the injunction on, that being compelled speech, what the court basically said was one of the elements of that was that there had to be an objection from the individual who was getting the sign put in front of his home. And there was no way of concluding that those individuals all objected to those signs being put in front of their homes without them actually testifying to that. Now, that may seem overly pointy to some of the listeners. I understand that, but as you point out, injunctions are not favored. So they're going to make the injunction as narrow as it can be in terms of who it affects and how it is imposed. So, you know, the court granted the injunction as to our three named petitioners, and that essentially sent the message to the sheriff that he was, going to do this at his own peril, putting signs in front of anybody else's home. As far as I know, he chose not to do that, which I think was probably a wise decision on his part. And so we didn't have any problems in Butts County on Halloween, either, you know, from the sheriff placing these signs in front of registrants' homes, or I'm happy to report with anybody reporting any kind of problems with children being harassed or bothered or anything along those lines that would have, contradicted our position that these signs were unnecessary. Still there? Hello?
Larry, I'm still here, Mark. Did we lose Larry?
It might appear that we have Larry. Lost Larry.
Well, Mark, you and I can take care of it.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, I tend to be so boring that people will hang up from time to time, so I don't blame you at all, Larry. regardless,
let me spice it up. Oh, yeah. There he is.
Can you hear me now?
Mark.
Yes, I hear you just fine.
Okay, so Sheriff Long vowed from the beginning to the Georgia media that he was going to appeal. He has, in fact, appealed the granting of the injunction. Yeah. And this is where it gets a little bit dicey because there's complexities of the original case is moving forward. We've got an appellate case, and then Axel has joined Narsil in doing an amicus brief. So Sheriff Long appealed. What is he appealing? Hasn't the injunction collapsed when the calendar turned over to November 1st?
Well, yeah. the sheriff is appealing the grant of the preliminary injunction. Now, you know, by its own terms, the preliminary injunction expired the day after Halloween. It was simply saying that the sheriff couldn't put signs out in front of our clients' homes on Halloween. And so Halloween passed and the order no longer, is in force. And so basically, our position, or at least our primary position on appeal, is that this order is moot. That meaning that, typically, a case isn't heard on appeal for sure, when the court's order is not going to have any effect on the parties. So at this point, if the 11th Circuit came back and said that the order was improperly granted, that's not going to have any effect because the order's already expired anyway. They just go back and say, well, you know, Judge Treadwell, you made a mistake. So that's the primary position we took. Now, interestingly, very often when you have a case of an injunction, and the party that loses wants to appeal it, the court will sort of, as a matter of course, grant a stay in discovery. Since the preliminary injunction usually comes during or before, as in our case, discovery commences. Judge Treadwell, and I believe, his reasoning was that, he believed that the appeal was moot. Judge Treadwell declined to grant the other side's motion, to stay discovery while the appeal was ongoing. So we are plowing forward with discovery as we speak. And, the court's calendar for the discovery process indicates that we should be done with discovery and then motions following discovery, which typically are a motion for what's called motion for summary judgment, where the parties say that, you know, there's no disputes as to the facts of this case. It's just a question of how the law applies to those facts. Summary judgment motions, would be due to the court sometime in September, I believe, early September. And so at this point, we would anticipate that not only is discovery going to be complete, but we'll probably have a final ruling from the court rather than a preliminary ruling like the injunction. We'll have a final ruling from the court on the case, by the time the next Halloween rolls around in 2020. So October 31st, 2020. At least that's the goal. I mean, I honestly think that both sides really want that situation resolved by then. It certainly is in our client's interest to do so. I think it's also probably in the sheriff's interest to do so. So we are moving right along with discovery.
Well, I want to clarify for our listeners, this is a little pontification. I've gotten a lot of, I wouldn't call it hate mail, but questioning Narsil's position on this. They're telling me that there's Halloween restrictions from coast to coast, and we went into Georgia. What made the Georgia case much more appealing to us? We would like to go into Missouri next, but Georgia doesn't have a law. Georgia doesn't have anything that says a person must put up signs. That makes, in my view and Narsil's view, the standard a little bit easier because you're arguing about the presumption of constitutionality. We didn't have to make that argument in Georgia. There's no deference to presumption of constitutionality because there is no law in Georgia. This was two sheriffs who decided to act unilaterally on their own volition to require signage on Halloween. And therefore, we don't have to have all that debate about the legal standard, whether it's rational basis, whether it's intermediate scrutiny, all that stuff. We don't have to get into that because there is no authority for what Sheriff Long is doing.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I mean, that covers the second, position that we've taken, which is that, you know, the sheriff lacked authority to go forward, as he did. Now, the sheriff's position is that there's sort of a catch-all position in the code that says that the sheriff shall make the public, aware of the registry and the registered offenders' names. What we have contended in our briefing is that, you know, yes, that statute exists. I mean, we're not disputing that. But that statute, follows a list of about four or five specific locations where the sheriff is expected to publish the registry, including the internet. So what we're saying is not so much that that's not what the statute says, as we are that the sheriff has restrictions in terms of how he can get the word out and spread the word. And placing signs in front of the homes of registrants is simply not one of the items that he's authorized to do. And, you know, there's also something we said about the fact that the statute certainly authorizes the sheriff to publish the registry in toto with all of the names of the offenders in one place. But it does not, anywhere I can see it, authorize the sheriff to individually identify registrants, which can be, you know, it can be a safety threat for the registrants. If they're putting signs in front of the homes, you increase the risk of vigilante type action, or, you know, on Halloween, just vandalism. Kids picking those particular homes to, you know, roll with toilet paper or eggs or whatever kids do now that I didn't do 25 years ago, I swear.
Hey, Mark, yes. This is Janice in California. I just wanted to say that, you know, we had, three cases involving two cities here. One of them, the entire Department of Corrections. But yeah, the whole idea too, and, of the fact that the danger that's posed by requiring somebody to have a sign, and then in California, it was only the day of Halloween. In Georgia, it was a longer period of time than that. But of all the times in the whole, you know, year to have on Halloween, I mean, that placed an extra danger, not only for the registrant, but also for the other people living in the home. And, you know, folks, the people who are in the registry, you know what, we can't have weapons in California, right? So I remember with one of the cities that when the city council adopted their ordinance for the Halloween signs, I was warning registrants. I said, you should leave and not be at home on Halloween, because what's going to happen if somebody shoots a shotgun into your house, right? I mean, you can't protect yourself or the people who are living in your home. And at least that law did not require you to be in your house on Halloween. So I said, go get a hotel room, go stay with friends or relatives, because it was really going to be a danger inside the house. And I was very gratified when our federal district court judge, when he approved a TRO, temporary restraining order, in Simi Valley, California, he got it. He completely understood the physical danger that these signs pose. And I would say in Georgia, again, it was even worse because the signs were going to be up even longer.
Yeah, and I'd like to point out quickly that Janice's work in Simi Valley actually helped me out a lot in Macon, in the Middle District of Georgia. And I referred to Janice's, the opinion from Janice's case that she's talking about. Interestingly, as I started to, the judge, who was extremely well prepared for this hearing, I have to say, the judge, said, you know, is that the Simi Valley case? Yes. Oh, I've already read that. So he was familiar with the case, and I think that case was persuasive to him, which, for those of you that do not live in the Southeast and have the great pleasure of living on the West Coast, there's certainly a stigma and a bit of a snobbishness, among the courts in the South about the Ninth Circuit, which covers California among others. And just how the courts around here often choose not to pay much attention to what the Ninth Circuit has to say, because it's just the loony left and all those other things. But in this case, I was really surprised, pleasantly, to have a federal judge who not only had read a case that I didn't put a name in my briefing or anything like that, but was very much, relevant to what we were arguing. But he also really sort of took, the basic argument from that and applied it in our case as well.
Yeah. Here's a sentence, just one sentence from that decision. And it says, the court concluded that public labeling of registrants' homes on Halloween, quote, poses a danger to sex offenders, their families, and their property. Its function and effect is likely to approximate that of Hawthorne's scarlet letter, potentially subjecting them to dangerous mischief common on Halloween night and to community harassment in the weeks and months following. So, I mean, that's a federal district court judge. It's language.
Yeah. I mean, it's like I said, I mean, we run against headwinds so often advocating these positions that it's always sort of a pleasant surprise when you run into a judge who gets it, like Janice said. That's great. I mean, it really did feel good to have a judge that at least was going to stay neutral, you know, in terms of the arguments of the parties.
Mm-hmm. And so, Larry, you mentioned briefly, I'd like to repeat the fact that Axol and Narsol together submitted an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief in this case, to support Mark in his position. And one of the really important things, and probably the most important thing that we did in the amicus brief, was to educate the judge. So there's a lot of social science research out there. And in fact, I'm looking at, you know, page 28 of our brief here, and we quoted Emily Horowitz. She says, there's no research that sex offense increases on Halloween, no evidence that sex offenders target children on Halloween, and in fact, no evidence that a child has ever been a victim of sexual abuse by a stranger while out trick-or-treating. So if you think, and that's what you're balancing, no harm, with these horrendous signs and really, a terrible violation of the First Amendment, and the fact that the government here is compelling people on the registry to speak. So compelled speech is the term, the legal term. It's just so easy, I'd say. It's not that it's ever easy, right, Mark, to get injunctive relief. But when you balance these factors here, it's easier for even a federal district court judge to agree with us. And folks, I'm looking forward to helping Missouri later this year, because we know Missouri has a similar situation.
And we're looking forward to that, Janice. And let me just be clear about the amicus brief. It wouldn't have happened without Axol. We were short of writing help at the time that this needed to be done. So this is really the product of what Axol has done to put the brief in. And we're actually going to post it as soon as we're given the go-ahead, either from the attorneys or when the court accepts it. So the people that support Axol and Narsol will be able to see this product. But right now, we're holding it until we get the go-ahead that the court's going to accept it. Mark, I wanted to talk to you about the appeal, because the appeal, we're hoping that they simply extinguish the appeal and say we'll deal with this later. But in the meantime, you're proceeding with discovery. This case doesn't look like it's going to have a lot of discovery. Are you reasonably optimistic that we can resolve this case by Halloween of 2020 at the trial level?
Yeah,
at the district court level?
Based on the court schedule, I forecast that there will be a dispositive ruling. And when I don't mean to try to go over everyone's heads with the legal terminology, but dispositive ruling just means a final order, as opposed to the preliminary order we got last Halloween, a final order, the end of the case. I'm guessing we'll get one. I think the court's schedule was crafted in a way to assure that there is a final order prior to Halloween 2020. Now, whether or not that's going to be well advanced of Halloween 2020, I don't know. That got slowed down by the other side seeking to appeal the case. But regardless, I believe, discovery is over in this case before Labor Day. So then the two sides will presumably have, about 30 days, I believe, to file motions, which both sides will file, saying that there's no reason to have a trial because the judge can resolve this without need for a jury. And my best hunch is that'll be how the case resolves, that there won't be any disputed facts that a jury would typically resolve. It's just a question of how the law applies to what everybody agrees happened. So that's what I suspect will happen. We've still got a long way to go between now and then. But my guess is that's where we're headed.
So, Mark, one of the big differences, too, in our cases, again, California, you know, compared to Georgia, folks in our cases had to put signs on the front door of where they lived. And in your situation, I was intrigued by and not in a positive way, by the government's argument that the signs weren't on the property owned by the registrant. So in other words, they kind of put them in the private public right of way, and so that was supposed to somehow solve the problem. I thought maybe if you addressed that, that would people be interested in that.
Well, yeah, I mean, the sheriff came up with what I will just call a nuanced argument, saying that no, these signs were not in front of anyone's home; they were in rights of way. There's a lot to be said about that argument. The way I can summarize it is this. What they call the right of way is an area of land, in front of the homes of these folks, that in my opinion is totally indistinct from the property line. The only way you know what a right of way is to consult the law, which isn't altogether clear anyway, and measure things out. It's not because there's some natural barrier between right of way and property. And one of our clients in the injunction hearing had actually back in 2018, he snapped a picture of the sign that they put out in front of his home. And the picture shows this sign out in front of his home and actually behind his mailbox. So you got this sign that's behind the mailbox, but in front of the house, and somehow, some way, the sheriff is trying to persuade the judge and everyone else around that these signs are not going to be readily associated with the people who live in that home. It's as I said, nuanced would be one way of describing the argument. Nonsensical might be another.
I was going to add the word ridiculous.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that the sheriff tried to kind of have it both ways, because the legal argument was, oh, hey, these aren't associated with their homes. They're in rights of way. This is the government speaking. This isn't the registrant speaking. No reasonable person would think the registrant put this sign out. And then, on the other hand, the sheriff testified, because, he was testifying honestly, that that the signs themselves were placed where they were placed with the express purpose of associating the signs with the people who lived in the homes. So, I think it was a novel argument. I see why they were trying to go that way. There was certainly an effort there to muddy the waters and make it so that the issue was what they characterize as government speech, which is kind of an evolving area of the law. But it essentially says that the government, the government's not held to the First Amendment, when it's speaking as the government. But those are things like, the example they gave in their brief was a wanted poster. That is a factual statement, supported by facts. It's important to note here that the sheriff, even though, the position that they took was that these signs were associated with these people because they're registrants, there was a Facebook post that made that link explicit. The signs themselves did not say sex offender. The signs instead said danger, or that the no trick or treating, and that it was a public safety message from the sheriff. So what they ended up saying was not that a registrant lives in this home, which is a statement of fact. It would be hard to say it's not a statement of fact. What instead they said was that this home's a hazard, it's dangerous. And that wasn't supported by any part of any fact that they put in the record, or it's not going to be supported by any fact they could put in the record in this case.
The signs in California were similarly worded. So, it's kind of a surprise that they're not, it's not like you have to wear a sign that says Scarlet Letter. It's not like in Nazi Germany I guess, where you're wearing a yellow star. But on the other hand, when the government, and I know they, that sheriff did in your case, and we had law enforcement in our cases as well, basically saying, you know, expressing to the public that the reason these signs are out being put out is because the person, you know, poses a current danger. Even though in California, I mean, it didn't make any difference if you'd been on the registry for 50 years. They, you know, they are basically broadcasting that you were a current danger. And I have another favorite line from the Simi Valley case I just love to read to everybody, because I think this will make you, everybody, I hope it makes everybody who's listening to this feel really good and understanding that there are some federal district court judges out there who understand the situation. Because this is what this judge said, that the public interest is not served. Indeed, it is undermined by enforcement of an unconstitutional law singling out a discrete outcast group to speak in such a way that their person's property and loved ones may be endangered. I mean, that is such strong language. And, you know, and I'm pretty sure, Mark, that you quoted this in your briefs as well. And I know we did in our amicus brief here, because I mean, it, I don't think it could be, have been expressed any more clearly that the, this judge understands that, in fact, you know, that these Halloween signs basically are creating a danger. And again, not just to the registrant, but also to the, whoever's living with the registrant, right? And then, of course, also emphasizing that the law itself is unconstitutional.
Mark, yeah, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Not at all. Please go ahead, Larry.
Oh, I was just going to try to find out how much more. I would like to do a little bit on Spalding, and then I'd like to give you some time on the removal process. Now, California will soon be joining the club of removal processes. But Spalding County, we filed in Spalding County as well, which is an adjoining county to Butts. What's the status of that lawsuit in Spalding?
Yeah, Spalding is actually pretty close to Butts, but oddly enough, it's in a different federal jurisdiction. That case is in the Northern District of Georgia, which is, it's the biggest court is in Atlanta, but this one's actually in Newnan, Georgia. When we filed against Spalding, they almost immediately announced that they were going to voluntarily not put signs out for Halloween. So that eliminated the need for a preliminary injunction as we got in Butts. And so at the moment, we are about to begin discovery in earnest with Spalding. We have spoken with their lawyers about resolution of the case, but nothing has gotten too far as that goes. And they've actually made a motion to dismiss our petition. So the judge needs to rule on that motion to dismiss before anything else is going to go forward. And we'll just have to take it from there. You know, Spalding is far less developed at this point than Butts. The sense is we're dealing with a less combative entity in Spalding than we are in Butts, but you know that could absolutely change very quickly. So you know we're just working away on both of them and focused on neither in particular, more like just juggling both as we speak.
Well, before we go into removal process, it's just I always try to use this platform to educate our people about the complexity and the cost of this type of litigation. And Narsil did provide some seed money, but you're into this case, your firm and the other attorney, corporating attorney, Mr. Begnaud, you're into this for tens of thousands of billable hours. And these things go on and on and on with protracted litigation. Those who were on the previous hour, the Michigan case has been going on since 2011. We were in 2020. So these things are draining financially to the law firms. And, I'm not asking you how much money you've got into it, but is it safe to say that it's approaching six figures?
Yeah, I don't even want to get into exactly what the numbers are. But I will say that, you know, we're dealing with legally complex issues and legally difficult issues. And as much as I think the sheriff has gone way beyond his authority under the law in the state of Georgia, although interestingly, this case has spurred some legislators to try to pass some laws that would authorize exactly this kind of activity. You know, the sheriff, you know, misguided as he might be, really does believe he's doing something legal. The sheriff testified, as a matter of fact, that he consulted with the prosecuting attorney's counsel of Georgia, before he posted these signs. And we have reason to believe that these signs were the product of some kind of a sheriff's association in Georgia that had encouraged its members to post the signs. The signs are exactly the same in both Butts and Spalding, and there's another county, Camden, that we're aware posted the signs as well last fall. So, you know, it's not an accident that this all happens, and you know they've got an agenda just as much as we do. The sheriff's agenda was to publicize this because he wanted to get reelected, and he did. You know, our agenda is obviously to fight for the constitutional rights of our clients and make sure that, you know, various legal entities don't feel like they can just kick registrants around any way they want to find out just how far they can push the law. So, you know, I mean, I'm not really interested in talking about how far we are in money-wise. It's significant, and it'll become more significant, particularly in the case of Butts. We think because it's just going to be a pitched battle. The sheriff has shown no desire to resolve the case in the way that we want to. And so, you know, we fully expect it to be a fight to the death, more or less.
I'm not trying to get numbers out of you. I was trying to get the complexity and the cost in terms of the big picture. People don't understand. Our listeners don't understand. They think this is a letter. You send a letter to the other side and they capitulate. We're talking about tens of thousands of dollars of billable hours. You easily worked 100 hours on that brief. I've written briefs before, and I know that 100 hours of billable hours that you don't collect for years, or maybe not at all, can be a significant hit on your firm. That's the point I'm trying to make to our listeners.
Yeah, don't keep reminding me of it.
This is an educational opportunity for people to understand that this is a big risk that an attorney is taking to do this type of litigation when we're challenging something of this magnitude.
I need to be very clear about the fact that I'm not the only attorney at risk here. First of all, of course, Janice was kind enough to put some of her time into this and file an amicus brief, and she gets nothing out of that no matter what. So we really appreciate her support, as well as myself, of course. But Mark Vegno, who's working with me on this case, and this is really sort of outside of his purview. I asked him to associate in because he is an attorney who handles a lot of civil rights type actions, a lot of Section 1983 suits, and is very well versed in those kind of actions. And he has been nothing short of invaluable for me in guiding this case through the litigation. So, I mean, I couldn't have done without him. I couldn't have gotten to this point without him. He's a phenomenal lawyer, brilliant. And we really enjoyed working together on this. And we better have enjoyed it because, you know, I mean, as you said, there's no money at the end of this unless we prevail. And that's nothing of a guarantee. I mean, the 11th Circuit is a really tough place, for any kind of action like this. So we shall see.
Janice, you have nothing else on this. I promised Mark a little time on deregistration removal in Georgia. So do you want to go any further, or can we move to deregistration?
I think I'll sign off now. Thank you. Bye-bye.
No, you can stay with us, but deregistration is something that a few states have. California soon to join that club of deregistration petitions. So Mark,
I'll be sure to listen to the recording. Thank you.
Mark, you've been on with us before, and we've talked about this, and we never seem to have enough time, and same thing's going to happen tonight. But Georgia provides a process for people to be removed from registration. And there's some that are easier than others. And so I want to just cover the surface about who can file a petition and what that process looks like at the onset. So who can ask to be removed from registration in the state of Georgia?
Hello, Larry, are you there?
Yes, go ahead.
Larry? Hello?
Hey, Mark, are you still there?
Hello, Larry. Yes, I am.
Okay, Larry had asked you what does it take for someone to get removed from the registry?
The removal process in Georgia is one where after certain conditions are met, a registrant can make an application to a court to be removed from the registry. The conditions that are met can be something like a health-related reason, like if they're in hospice, in a nursing home, residential care, something like that, total and permanent disability, which is something different, serious physical incapacitation due to illness or injury, also a way you can come off in Georgia. But barring a health-related issue, the way you can come off is for Georgia's Sexual Offender Registration Review Board, called SORB, to classify you in one of three tiers of offenders based on risk level. This is not uncommon among other states. Are you with me? Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. It's not uncommon among the states to have this tiered classification and, coincident obligations for registrants that go up depending on your risk level. Georgia's, as far as I know, is kind of unique in that there's a non-judicial executive level board that is appointed or tasked with doing that classification, and they aren't given a whole lot of guardrails in terms of who they can and cannot classify. I argued a case involving this in Georgia Supreme Court shortly after Park last year, and the Supreme Court kind of punted on it. But I do think that there are some issues there that are going to crop up sooner or later in front of Georgia's Supreme Court. But simply put, if SORB classifies you as a low-level risk, then you're able to apply to come off of the registry as soon as you have completed your entire sentence, meaning not only prison sentence, but also probation, parole, supervised release, what have you. If you are found to be a level two offender, then you are able to apply to come off of the registry 10 years after completion of your sentence. And same with a third level, which is also the dreaded SDP, sexually dangerous predator classification. The Supreme Court pointed out that it's unlikely that levels that a tier three, that a predator is going to come off of the registry, but that you are able to make that application at least, and could probably make some hay with a couple of the standards that they have.
So is everybody hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. If you're level one, immediately upon completion of your court imposed obligations, a level two after 10 years, and you filed this petition in the county that you're convicted, right? What happens for people who were not convicted? What happens to people who weren't convicted in Georgia? Where do they file their petition?
Well, in the county where you live, where you reside. So if you move to Atlanta, most of Atlanta is in Fulton County. And so you'd file in Fulton County. If you were Macon, it would be Bibb County. What have you. You'd file it in the county where you reside.
And what's the burden, and who bears the burden to show whatever needs to be shown to get to be relief from the registration obligation?
Yeah, the burden's on the registrant, because you're the one asking to come off of the registry. The burden's on the registrant to show by what's called a preponderance of the evidence, which is, you can think of it as a 50% plus one, so more likely than not, that they do not pose a substantial risk of perpetrating any future sex offense. So that's the obligation you have. I've handled a lot of these. The burden is a heavy one, but it's not an impossible to overcome one.
So have you done enough of these? I know you've done a number of them. Have you done enough of them to get a feel for the various counties, if you were to go down to Plains and file one in Sumter County, would you get a different reaction if you filed it in Fulton or DeKalb or one of the metro counties that where you're quite familiar with in your practice?
You know, Georgia's a strange place. You know, on the one hand, you know, there's this natural assumption that the bigger the county, right, the more favorable likely to come up with in terms of they've seen it all, they've been through it all, and, you know, just about any kind of offense is not going to shock them in terms of fact. And so they might be a little bit more objective in terms of applying the law and saying, well, I don't think this guy's any kind of risk to reoffend, which ultimately is the question in front of the judge. I haven't found that to be the case. I've found judges in Fulton County who have been very difficult. And, you know, there are a couple judges in Fulton County who, spent their time in the practice of law prosecuting sex crimes. And so they are not the kind of judges who are going to be real, open to this kind of activity when they get one in front of them. Now, conversely, you can get out into some of these smaller counties, and I don't want to name any in particular because it's just not worth it to name any in particular. But you get out into some of these smaller counties, and the judges tend to be a little bit more libertarian, tend to be a little bit more hands-off government, and some of them, you know, even perish the thought had spent some time being defense lawyers before they took the bench. And you can get a judge who will listen carefully to your arguments and give you a fair run, if nothing else, in terms of trying to get a client off of the registry. So I don't think that there's any kind of consistency. There's no secret county where you can go and you know feel like you're just going to cruise through or anything like that. It's just not like that in Georgia.
Well, of course, you only have the option of the county you're convicted in unless you have an out-of-state conviction. I want to try to take a few phone calls. Right. So those who think that you might be interested in removal process, Mr. Yurchek is quite successful at doing that. So *6 will get you in the queue. And you could also ask about the Halloween stuff. But if you're interested in removal, and you may not even live in Georgia, for a matter of fact, but it's a process that you can take advantage of whether or not you do live in Georgia. If you happen to live in Georgia, you're better off, but people can move to other states. I've heard of that happening. So anyway, *6 will get you in the queue. And Mark, what is your telephone number, your contact information while we're waiting for people to get into the queue? How would they contact Mark Yurchek?
You can reach me in my office. The phone number is 470-319-8721. That's 470-319-8721. You can go to my website, which is myappealslawyer.com. That's my initials, MYAPPEALS, lawyer.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Mayfirm. So, you know, all of the above, please feel free to contact me any of those places.
Okay, well we've got some callers, so let's do it. Error code 562. Looks like you're from California. You're on Narsil in Action.
Hi there. Good morning or good afternoon. Good evening.
All three.
Yeah. I am originally from California. That's Norwalk is the county of my conviction, but I moved to Indiana last year for a job. And I know that Indiana has a process to be removed off of the registry, but my understanding is I would have to actually petition the convicting court, correct?
Well, I can't really speak to, you know, as a matter of fact, I do have a client who lives in Indiana, but I'm not extremely well versed.
That's not where he's going with the question. He's wondering if he would have to petition the Indiana court under Georgia law. And the answer is no. You would petition the court in the county in Georgia that you choose to live in. That's your question, right, sir?
No, you don't have to do it in Indiana.
You're right, but you cannot petition a Georgia court to help you with a conviction in Indiana. You're going to have to be in the state of Georgia.
Hey, Larry, maybe I can.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to not burn up time because you don't know anything about Indiana.
That's true.
Okay, so, I apologize for bringing my. Sorry for getting there.
No problem. All right, but thanks. All right, area code 810. You're on our connection. Area code 810. Can you hear me? Andy, are they hearing me?
They are hearing you.
Well, then we're going to put 810 back in the queue and go to the next because there's people stacked up here. Area code 574, you're on Arsenal Action.
Hey, Larry, it's Michael Harris in Indiana. Just was going to answer his question. You petitioned the court in the county you live in and you register in for removal, but you have to be on the registry for 10 years to do it in Indiana.
I appreciate that, Michael. And when we have a person from another state that's not practicing there, I'm always careful about giving out advice because it's just hard enough to know what the requirements are in your own state, much less to start speculating. But Michael, we take that from you with great deference because you do live there and you're an activist. So thanks.
Yep.
Area code 321. You're on Northland Action.
Yes. I'm here in Florida. And I have heard on a number of occasions that, you should move to Georgia because you can apply to be removed. But I'm not getting the impression that out-of-state people would be eligible for this removal just by moving to Georgia. What is the answer to that?
Well,
great question.
So the answer to the question is, It doesn't matter if you're from out of state, if you're not, if you meet the conditions under Georgia law to be removed, you can be removed. But I mean, I can't emphasize enough that the idea of carpetbagging to Georgia in order to try to get yourself removed out of Georgia's registry is not the greatest idea on the planet. Let me tick off a couple of reasons why. Number one, Georgia, the state of Georgia is not your friend. If you are a registrant, they are constantly coming up with new and inventive ways to try to violate your rights and really, invade your privacy. The legislation that's up in front of Georgia, up in Georgia's house right now, for which I feel personally responsible because, you know, a lot of it's based on two cases that I worked on, the Halloween case and the ankle monitoring case, which Larry mentioned, which is a year old this week. The changes they're making to the law are unbelievable and certainly preposterous. Among them, Georgia's about to try to raise up the maximum penalty for all sex offenses. Everything ranging from, all the way down to flashing, okay? Up to a potential life sentence. With the idea that if they do that, then they can use ankle monitoring on registrants, as long as they're on probation, which is what the Park case said. This is the legislature that you'd be moving yourself to with the idea that you're finding some safe haven. Number two, courts can see through these kinds of actions. And if you're a registrant and you move here with the idea of simply getting here and then making the motion to, come off the registry, I'm pretty sure most courts are going to be able to see what the scam is there. And if they start getting wind of this happening more often than just every once in a while, there's going to start being legislation about that kind of stuff. Now, having said that, I've represented a couple of registrants who have moved here from out of state and sought their removal. And one I'm tied up in the courts with on some sort of issues collateral to the removal itself, and another one I was completely successful with. So yes, absolutely, you could move here from out of state and certainly get yourself removed. I just would caution, don't use that as sort of the plan. You need to be careful with it. Also, something that hasn't been explored too much is the idea of SORNA. And the notion that if you move from one state to another, you've signed yourself up to be on for at least 10 years, because of that. Now, there may be some issues in terms of whether SORNA applies in the states and so on and so forth, but that's totally unexplored territory. And could certainly be a problem. So just a word to the wise. I mean, if you're coming here, come on. And if you need my help, I'll help you. But don't use this as some sort of launching pad. I think you'd really be disappointed with the results from that.
Well, Mark, we are going to have to wrap it up, and I want to give you time to give your phone number. And thank you so much for being with us, and we're going to do this again. So tell people how to reach you, or the easiest ways.
Yeah, I hope so. Okay, you can reach me. I'll just run down the list. You can reach me most easily. Call me, 470-319-8721. That's 470-319-8721. Website is myappealslawyer.com. That's www.myappealslawyer.com. Email is mark@myappealslawyer.com. We're on Facebook as well. Twitter, at Mayfro. Thanks so much, Larry.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure. Folks, we're going to be back after a break and we'll take the final hour. You're listening to Narsil in Action.
Okay.